Welcome back to the Persian Hour. We are fortunate to have a very special and wonderful guest with us today. His name is Brian Appleton. Brian is the author of a book called Tales from the Zirzamin. Brian lived and worked in Iran for many years in the pre-revolution era and left Iran a year after the revolution. Brian's acceptance of cultural differences and his appreciation of the rich Persian culture, along with his high energy and being a somewhat mischievous young man, were enough to provide many unique experiences that are much fun to read about in his book. Brian also has an interesting perspective on why the Iranian Revolution took place and is eager to counteract the mainstream media's negative stereotyping of Iran. And now I would like to introduce you to Brian Appleton, the author of the Tales from the Zirzamin. Welcome to the Persian Hour, Brian.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
I really appreciate you joining us. I've been reading some of your stories on Iranian.com, and I've always enjoyed them. And I got to say that I'm really happy that you finally decided to put all your stories, make a collection, and create a book so everyone else can also enjoy them.
Well, actually, you were one of the persons that encouraged me to do that about 5 years ago. You started saying that I should be doing that.
I'm glad. I'm so glad. So, Brian, tell me, at what age did you go to Iran, and why did you end up going to Iran?
Well, the first time I went to Iran, I was 16 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I went by myself, and my parents gave me a lot of latitude when I was growing up, which was great. I mean, of course, times were different in those days, but I first left home when I was 11 years old to go to boarding school in Rome. We were living in Italy. We were living in Livorno, which is about 200 miles from Rome, 200 miles north.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when I got to boarding school, it was actually just a day school, and we had sort of used Partibazi to get the principal to let us have, there were six boarders only. And one of these six boarders turned out to be a Persian student who was 1 year older than me, and his name is Tus Sepeir. And he didn't speak any English, and I didn't speak any Persian. And so in sixth grade, and he was in seventh, we were in boarding school together. We shared a room. We became really good friends, and he started teaching me Persian, and I started teaching him English. And believe it or not, he's still my best friend after all these years. And so what happened was when we were leaving Italy to come back to the United States permanently, in 1966, I told my family, you know, you go ahead and spend the summer packing. I'm going to Iran. So I went, and I had a fantastic time with his family. And actually, it's quite funny because when I got to the airport in Mehrabad, they didn't have the new international one yet. I was all by myself, and I saw this absolute wall of people with their faces pressed up against the glass at the passenger terminal. I said, oh, my God, how am I ever going to find my friend? Well, all of a sudden, there was a section of this wall of people that started jumping up and down like the human wave at a stadium. And they had brought out all their relatives, all their friends, like the barber on their street. That whole neighborhood had come out to meet me. It was just awesome, and they carried my luggage. They carried me. I said, "Okay, I know I'm in good hands." And we had a great time. We went to Shomal that summer, and we just did so many things.
I read some of your stories from back then, and it sounded like you had somewhat of a lavish and mischievous lifestyle for a while.
Yeah, you know, it turns out that they come from an old aristocratic family, mm-hmm. and they're related to, like, Mostofis and some of these old top 50 aristocratic families from Qajar days. And so I had a kind of a different experience than a lot of foreigners had in Iran. And we went to a lot of parties, a lot of weddings, and then later, when I was living there in my 20s, in 1974, I actually acted in a couple of films in Iran because my friend Tus's aunt, Parvin Ansari, who lives in Rome, was making a film about the, it was a documentary about Pietro della Valle, who was an Italian nephew of the Pope at the time, who went to get an audience with Shah Abbas to try to get him to side with Europe against the Ottomans. And it's a true story, and what happened is the astrologers of the court of Shah Abbas kept telling him that the stars weren't right for meeting a foreigner, and so he kept evading him and going to his summer castle up in the north and his winter castle somewhere else. And so finally, so it was great because I had just arrived in Iran, and I got to see the whole country moving around, following wherever Shah Abbas had gone to get away from the Italian visitor. And he finally got an audience with him. Well, the part I played was Sir Robert Shirley, who the Shirley brothers historically came to his court and helped him organize a modern army. And, you know, I don't like that part so much, but they basically, you know, sold him weapons and artillery and helped organize his army make it a national army, I guess, like was happening in the rest of the world, and take it off a feudal base. Mm-hmm. And so I played that historic part, and Sir Robert Shirley actually married the Shah's daughter. So I had a Persian wife and daughter in the film.
Uh-huh. So after acting, I think you started working for Bell Helicopter. Is that true?
Well, I went through a lot of different employers. At first, when I went there, I worked for the Iranian Air Force teaching English to the soldiers, because English was the international language for aviation and control towers and that sort of thing. So the whole the Air Force was learning English, and that was a lot of fun because I was basically teaching boys that were like 17, 18, 19 years old, and a lot of them were from little villages like Gorgan, and they were excited about being in Tehran, the big city, and they were always more interested in who, you know, if I was dating girls than if I was if they were learning English. So I did that for 2 years, and then I worked for Iranian shipbuilding company called Iran Marine Industrial Company, or Iran Marine Industries Company, and that was actually pretty amazing because I was about 27, and I had been tutoring the owner of this shipbuilding company he was the president of Bank Sadarat, and I was tutoring him, and one day, and I really liked his family, I ended up teaching his whole family English, and I would spend so much time at their house that my girlfriend thought I was having an affair, you know, because I was never home. So, anyway, one day I said to him, I kind of started looking at him like an uncle, and I said, you know, I'm tired of teaching. I like teaching you, but I'm thinking about my future, and I'd like to work for some kind of a company. And he said, well, what are you interested in? So he started going through different companies that the bank owned. And one of them was like a housing developer and prefab houses, and that didn't sound very interesting. He finally got to the shipbuilding company, and I said, well, I don't know anything about it, but I love ships and I love the sea. And so he gave me the number of somebody to call who was the vice president of that shipbuilding company, and the next day I had an interview, and I ended up assistant manager with 400 subordinates, and I had two consultants that basically ran everything for me. One was Persian and the other was German. One was a naval architect who'd studied in Naples, so I spoke Italian to him, and the German was a naval engineer. But it was really great because I could use my Parti Bazi from my old family to actually help them, and we got an audience with the Minister of Interior to get tariff protection for the Iranian shipbuilding industry, because they didn't have any at the time, and our competitor was bringing ships in from Thailand or Singapore that were actually cheaper than what it cost us to build them in Iran. So even though I was a kid and I didn't really know what I was doing, I think I did a lot of things for them.
Right. You used the term Parti Bazi. Would you define that, please?
I guess In English, I would say influence peddling.
Yes, that's, you're exactly right. So, Brian, did you converse in Farsi when you were working, or was it in English?
Well, actually, I had to. I had studied Persian for about a year in a class in Washington, D.C. when I was in college before I went over to Iran. I had planned to go. And but, it was fine for learning grammar and the alphabet and things like that. But as far as day-to-day conversation and slang and everything, you have to learn that in the country, really. And so when I got the job at Bell Helicopter, and they, being a new hire, I got a position that nobody else wanted, which was employee relations.
Mm-hmm.
And every time an American or his one of his dependents got in trouble, I had to get them out.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my first day on the job, I had to get my boss's brother out of jail. And I didn't think I was going to do it, and I went down there, and it's actually in my book about how I managed to talk the police into letting him out. And it was great. I was forced to use Farsi and to learn it. You know, when you're in a situation where you're depending on it, you really learn the language quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I've forgotten a lot, but the amazing thing is that once I left Iran, I thought I'd never have any reason to speak Persian again. And then when I came to California, there's like several million Iranian-Americans here, and I speak it almost every day. I just couldn't believe it. A lot of my customers are Persian-Americans.
Uh-huh. You mentioned that your boss's brother got arrested. What was he arrested for?
Oh, you want to hear that story?
It's
actually quite comical. He had, there was a club that was called the Paris American Club, and he had a little too much to drink, and so when they were trying to close, he didn't want to leave. So they finally had to send, he was about 19, so they finally had to send in a couple of policemen, and he started fighting with them, and he threw one of them in the swimming pool. So they took him to jail. So I get my first day on the job, and my boss says, you have to go get my brother out of jail. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, no, you just have to do it. So I went down to the police station, and I had to think up a story in the taxi. I mean, I had a driver, actually. I had to think up a story on the way there. I thought, okay, what am I going to say? So I was thinking on my feet, and I said to the police chief, I said, you know, he got a little too excited last night, had a little too much to drink, because he just proposed marriage to an Iranian girl, and her family gave their consent, and he was really happy, so he got a little too happy. And so they said, oh, okay, we understand. And then I said, so what can I do to get him out of jail, or what can I do to make things right? So the police chief said, well, and this was all in Farsi, and so the police chief said, well, why don't you talk to the policeman that he was fighting with and see what he would like. So I started talking to him. He's a really nice guy, and I said, you know, what can I do to make it better? And he said, well, we have to buy our own uniforms. And he tore my shirt, and I have to go to a tailor and get it fixed. And so I said, how much do you think that would be? And it was probably not even, maybe $10 or less, because I remember in those days I could get a whole shirt made for like $15.
Mm-hmm.
So I paid him. And next thing I know, I'm in the taxi with my boss's brother on the way back to the office, and I couldn't believe it. I was, like, in shock. I mean, can you imagine what would happen in the United States if you punched a policeman?
Oh, you'd be
in Cuba. You'd probably still be in jail.
So at one point, you decided to become a Muslim, and you converted. Is that true?
Yes. To be perfectly honest, I haven't been a very adamant follower, more of a nominal Muslim. You know, I do Ramadan because it's a great way to diet.
Then you're a better Muslim than I am.
But that's really my main motive, is to lose weight. But I learned that from Persians. You know, they said that was a great time to go on a diet. But what happened, this is a funny story too, it was actually made the newspapers in Tehran. What happened is that I was actually, my Persian family were related to a very famous family. The grandfather was Mirza Hassan Ashtiani Mostofi al-Mamalek from Vanak, where it was a separate village in the western part of Tehran yet. And he was prime minister 11 times.
Wow.
And both under two different dynasties, under the Qajar and under the Reza Shah. So the guy was quite a clever politician to be able to survive that transition. And but his granddaughter developed a crush on me, and she told her cousin, my best friend, you know, I want to marry this guy. So I loved her family. And so we had this debut. It was almost like a scene out of The Godfather. We went to the uncle's palace in Vanak, and I was walking with her. This was like our first formal, you know, introduction. I mean, I'd seen her at parties and stuff. But anyway, I was walking like 20 feet with her 20 feet ahead of all the families, and my Persian family was representing me, and her family next to them. And so we were like 20 feet ahead walking around this beautiful garden so that we could have privacy, but that they could keep their eyes on us. It was so funny. And so basically, my family made me shave my mustache because they said you look too bazari with mustache. You have to clean yourself up. And and they said, of course, you have to convert to Islam. So we had a ceremony at the Tehran Rotary Club, and Imam Jomei, who was the Shah's personal priest, was the one who performed the ceremony. And I had Khalid Bari was there, who was the foreign minister for the Shah. There were all kinds of dignitaries. There was Khosrow Iqbal, who is the brother of Manoushehr Iqbal, the famous Dr. Iqbal. And it made all the papers, and but basically I never went through with the marriage because I was too American still to believe in arranged marriages. I mean, it's just something I couldn't get myself to go through with it. I also didn't really want to get married yet, you know.
Right.
But of course now I wish I had. I mean, I shouldn't say that. You know, I'm happily married. I have two kids, 16.
I think you're
20,
sleeping
but,
on the couch tonight.
Huh?
I think you're sleeping on the couch tonight.
Probably. Yeah, you know, the thing is that you know, you look back and you look at your life and you look at roads not taken, and it's just, you know, here are these people that they were living in the lap of luxury, and yet they were not arrogant, they were not snobs, they were loved by the people. That everybody remembered this family, and in fact, during the revolution, nobody touched any of their palaces or any of their possessions. They were completely safe because everybody knew, you know, that the grandfather was a great man who was a great statesman and who had done a lot to help, you know, the Iranian people. And, you know, the whole constitutional revolution that was around that era. So it was really a privilege to know that family.
Mm-hmm.
Let's
Brian,
put it that way.
I want to talk politics. And
yes.
In fact, I'd like to read a short paragraph from your book. You said,
okay.
In such a beautiful country and culture, I had been blinded from the plight of a lot of very unhappy people. I could not fathom that we were on the eve of a revolution. It was the quiet before the storm. Some people knew it and could see it coming, but not me. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I've come to find that not just Americans, but almost any foreign community in another country tend to stay together. And a lot of times they don't learn the mainstream culture. I mean, I met a woman in Greece years ago. I rented a house from her to spend the summer, who had lived in Washington, D.C. for 50 years, and she couldn't speak a word of English.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what tends to happen is that the foreigners they live a life as an expat, which is actually much better than anything they could have had in their own country. And I think there have been a lot of movies about the British Empire that showed how they lived like lords in India, and back in their own country there might have been a postman or something. You know what
right.
I'm saying? So I think that the Americans in Iran in general had no idea that the revolution was coming, and in fact, to this point, there were only seven of us in all of Bell Helicopter, which had like 9,000 employees and dependents, who could even speak Farsi.
Mm-hmm.
And when Jaleh Square massacre took place, I lived in the south of Tehran, and it was only a few blocks from where I lived, maybe six blocks at the most. And I described this in my book, how I overheard the entire massacre and how, you know, the screaming and the crying. I mean, it started out as chants, and then at about when they started violating the curfew at 9 o'clock, and it went on until about 2 a.m. There were 5 hours of shooting and machine gunning, and at first I thought it was a soccer game going on at Amjadye, you know, which wasn't mm-hmm. too far from where I was. But then I started hearing the shooting, and then I knew, you know, that something bad was going on. And well, the very next day, they called a meeting at the headquarters of Bell Helicopter, and they said, okay, we don't want anyone spreading any rumors. Did anyone see anybody get shot? And we know something happened last night, but we don't know what it was, and let's not panic. And I said, well, you know, obviously none of us saw it because there was martial law curfew and we weren't allowed out of our houses. But I said, but you'd have to be pretty stupid not to understand that a lot of people got killed. I mean, I was so upset when the shooting and screaming and crying was going on that even though I couldn't see it, I was reduced to lying on the floor of my apartment and vomiting. I mean, I was just totally sick.
Right.
To my stomach, literally.
Okay. Brian,
yeah.
If you could spend 2 minutes and explain why the revolution came about, I would really appreciate it.
Well, I think there was a fundamental conflict between modernization and traditional society that mm-hmm. was going on. I mean, I remember the first time I went to Iran that summer when I was 16. My Persian family, they were trying to be nice to me, so they actually introduced me to an American girl who was a daughter of a missionary, and I dated her, and I took her to some of their parties, and then I would take her home back to her home, and her father wouldn't let her stay out past midnight. And I remember one time I was kissing her in the back of the taxi, and the driver got so offended that he pulled over and he called a policeman. And so I think, and you know, it's funny because after I had spent 5 years in Iran, and I remember when I was leaving and I was coming back through Paris, and I remember I felt shocked because I saw couples that were almost having sex in public, in parks and under bridges and things. And I'd been in Iran so long and hadn't seen that sort of behavior that I was actually shocked. And I think that, you know, the Shah was very proud of his modernization. And I remember a filmmaker that was making a film about Iran that I am dying to get a copy of called Le Vent des Amoureux. It was a French filmmaker. Filmed the entire history of Iran from ancient times to modern times from the air, and he told the story from the point of view of the wind. And actually, he died making that film because he was kind of a mystic himself, and he predicted he was going to die in Iran over water, and his helicopter crashed in Karaj Dam. And his wife finished the film, and he was awarded an Oscar for it posthumously. And but the reason I bring this up is that the Shah was pressuring him to include Karaj Dam and steel mills and all kinds of things to show the Western world that they were becoming modern. And it's almost like in Turkey when, you know, Ataturk, you know, got rid of the Arabic script and wouldn't let women wear hijab and all these things. And, you know, you just don't take thousands of years of tradition and just erase them and say, okay, from today we're going to be like everybody else. And the problem is that the West doesn't have all the answers. In fact, for every technological advance they've made, they've lost socially. I firmly believe that there's been an extremely high price for our technology and our technological society and our consumer way of life. I mean, in Iran, just to give you a really quick example that I think summarizes this, I was never alone unless I chose to be. I had so many friends, so many people I could count on when I needed something. I even had Muslim friends who knew I was Christian, this was before I converted, who would actually have a Christmas party for me because they didn't want me to be alone at Christmas. They knew it was my aid. And so here, you know, people have to pay a therapist to listen. I mean, we have such alienation in our society. People don't know their neighbors. I swear to God, Sharok, I on the street I've been living on in San Jose for 18 years, the only neighbors that I'm really good friends with that are next door to me are from Syria.
Mm-hmm. And I finally want to give you the opportunity to promote your book. Where can they get it? When is it going to come out?
Well, what I've done to try to generate some publicity and some interest in this book is to set up a website, and the website is very simple. It's www.zirzamin.com. So it's just one Persian word, and the way I'm spelling it so that English speakers, I mean non-Persian speakers, can pronounce it correctly is Z as in zebra, I as in Iran, R as in Robert, Z as in zebra, A as in apple, M as in Mary, E as in Edward, E as in Edward, N as in Nancy.
Brian, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great. Well, let me just say it one more time. It's www.zirzamin.com.
Great.
And God bless everybody, and thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Okay.